Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll remember the talk show host Phil Donahue. He changed television, and for a large part of his career, his show originated here in Illinois. Abortion was a big topic at the Democratic National Convention. Illinois has become a haven for those seeking the procedure, but money is running out for funds that pay for women to come here. We'll discuss protests at the convention and the balancing act for many activists. We'll talk about suicide prevention. School districts are in the final stages of getting COVID relief money, what that means for many districts, and what an investigation into homeschooling in Illinois discovered. Also, a liquor that has become synonymous with Chicago. But who actually drinks the stuff? The history of Malort, all this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The talk show host Phil Donahue died recently. He was 88. Sasha Ann Simons talked with the Chicago Sun-Times entertainment columnist Richard Roper about Donahue's career. Donahue spent nearly 30 years on TV, much of that in Chicago, speaking to issues relevant to his viewers. Nothing was off limits, from the AIDS crisis to the death penalty.
Lower the voltage down to 500 volts while the body sags back into the chair, and you hear a crackling and sizzling noise like bacon frying.
You've known you've had AIDS now for
6 months.
This is Chernobyl. That is the unit that blew last April.
I want to start, Richard, first by getting you to sort of describe how you saw Phil Donahue as a host. Like, what was it that stood out to you and other viewers about his style and his approach?
The thing that initially stands out is that when Phil Donahue came along, he was unlike anything we'd ever seen before. Most daytime talk shows back in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s were very light, and they were, you know, cooking segments and lifestyle segments, and a term we don't use much anymore, but really aimed at the housewife who was home. And Phil Donahue, Barbara Walters had a show that actually tackled issues, but most of that was in the evening. And Phil Donahue came along and started, as your great piece, you know, setting this up, started talking about the issues. But he also had, Sasha Ann, this theatricality to him. He had the mop of gray hair that became the mop of white hair, and he was very demonstrative. He was also really the first talk show host to go into the audience and make them a part of the show, much like you do on talk radio.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I feel like he was doing tabloid talk television before that became like an official genre. And those shows, they really served a distinct cultural purpose back then, Richard. I remember watching with my parents when I was little, and them being almost hungry for that shock value that they knew that Donahue would bring every time. But it really wasn't just the shock, was it? I mean, these were teachable moments a lot of the times, weren't they?
Yeah, he definitely, you know, would do the over-the-top things. He'd have Chippendales dancers on, or he'd put on a dress for a show about cross-dressing, mm-hmm. and he would do things like that. But he would also talk to world leaders. He would talk to Nelson Mandela. He would do a full interview with Ronald Reagan. And he would talk about issues that really weren't a part of the fabric of mainstream television at the time. He would talk about AIDS. He would talk about atheism. He would talk about birth control.
Right.
And this was at a time when these topics really were taboo on daytime television.
Yeah, you called him in your article an influencer before there were influencers.
He really was. And as you mentioned, you know, Oprah Winfrey talked about the fact that, you know, she came along. And of course, when you talk show daytime, that's the name that 99.9% of people are going to say, and rightfully so.
Right.
But Phil Donahue was a huge influence on that, because when Oprah Winfrey came to Chicago, first on a show called AM Chicago before she made it her own, Oprah was in the audience. Oprah was talking to audience members, taking calls on live shows.
Well, to your point that he pioneered the genre of talk show television, David Player, who's president of and CEO of the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, says that wasn't exactly the plan. Let's listen.
It was really kind of a fluke. There was an audience that was present for a show that wasn't going to happen that day. And they talked about the fact is, why don't we set up some chairs in the studio and see how that would work, actually having a live studio audience for these one-on-one interviews. It really became the signature for how talk shows were done.
That move, Richard, you know, getting an audience into the room, that style of talk show. What do you think was so captivating about it?
I think it gave the viewer at home a sense that they were part of the show, and they weren't just, it wasn't just one-way communication, because of course the studio audience just looked like America. Anybody that wanted to go could wait in line or, you know, write in for tickets. So you kind of felt like he was really talking to you because he was talking to regular folks in the bleachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to take it back to 1967. This is back in Dayton, Ohio. Donahue starts this local program, the Phil Donahue Show. And seemingly right away, he and his team say, okay, we got to do something different. So here's Donahue talking to WBEZ back in 2016.
The biggest challenge is staying current. And in my case, I was on at 10:30 in the morning, and this was the 1960s. And so we knew that the audience was predominantly female. And we also knew that we were very visually dull. I mean, two talking heads, nobody could figure us out. And we knew that the only way we could survive would be featuring issues about which our viewers cared. We felt we had to make them mad, sad, or glad, or we would not survive in Dayton, Ohio.
So staying current, Richard, and staying relevant in Dayton, Ohio, back in the 60s, that sounds like a tall order, doesn't it?
Absolutely. But, you know, that mad, sad, or glad thing is great. And I think the thing to remember, too, is, okay, yes, the audience was predominantly female, most of them probably at home, maybe with children. It doesn't mean that they weren't smart, and it doesn't mean that they didn't want to stay informed about the issues, especially when you think about the time we're talking about in the 60s and early 70s, when so much was going on in this country with the war in Vietnam and civil rights protests and so many other things going on. So the idea that old women who are staying at home just want cooking segments was never really, really accurate.
That ability to stay current and be shocking sometimes, did that start from the get-go?
I think so. Certainly by the time the show went nationwide, the reason why it caught on was because you did feel that you were getting the news from Phil Donahue, that it wasn't just something that could be taped 2 months in advance and would still be relevant. Mm-hmm. He was talking about what was in the headlines that week.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the first show when it was still a local show in Ohio. It featured Madeline Marie O'Hare, who's the atheist who played a big role in the Supreme Court's 1963 decision to ban the official reading of prayer in public schools. She was called the most hated woman in America, and this is his first guest ever. I want to play a little bit of Donahue back in 2016 telling WBEZ that story.
She came on and put her elbows on the table and leaned across almost in my face, and she said, "There are no angels, there is no heaven. There's no God. When you die, you go in the ground, you biodegrade, and you become part of the physical universe. This is the first show." Well, I mean, my dear, the building fell down in Dayton, Ohio. Sponsors canceled. I got lots of holy pictures. I think people are still praying for me in Dayton, Ohio. And everybody knew there was this new show on WLWD, you know, not that I wasn't grateful. I mean, we were very, very lucky.
Yeah. Do you think a show like that could be made today, Richard? Why or why not?
It could, and there are variations out there. But, you know, another big difference too, Sasha, was we're talking about a time when there were three or four channels available to the home viewer.
Oh, that's right.
That was it.
That's
right. You know, and there wasn't social media, and there was, you know, just the radio and the TV. So if something like that was on Channel 2, let's say, and then 5 and 7 had game shows and soap operas, you can almost hear the joy all those years later in Phil Donahue's voice talking about getting a guest like that. Because Donahue was great also about saying, like, hey, I'm not saying this. I'm just letting you know about the people who are saying it.
That's right.
What do you guys think?
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't really judgmental. He was giving them a platform. And then, hey, let's see what the audience has to say. I'm just here as the traffic cop.
That is very true. He did do a very good job of sort of playing that neutral role. Mm-hmm. What do you think it was that gave Donahue and his team the guts to go there with some of this conversation?
I think it's like anybody who does something pioneering, you know, they take those chances for whatever reasons. Phil Donahue, first of all, had brilliant instincts. Mm-hmm. The fact that they would put this, you know, hated atheist on the first show, you know, a lot of people knew who she was, but they would say, well, I'm not putting her on. I'm not giving her the platform. And Donahue had the smarts and also the temerity to say, no, this is something that's really happening in our culture. I'm going to go for it. And he loved the fact that he was getting sponsors canceling on him, or people were threatening to boycott or writing letters. It was that was what he wanted.
It's like, yes. I feel like Donahue ran so, you know, the Jerry Springers could walk. Is that the saying? Is that the phrase?
You know, that's the downside of it, unfortunately, is that you had this explosion of talk shows, and a lot of them, Jenny Jones was taped here in Chicago, Jerry Springer, there were many, many others
came
and went, Morton Downey Jr., but they looked at Phil Donahue and took all the sensationalistic elements and added no context, no depth, no intelligence, nothing but just, unfortunately, a lot of times, just a circus. They took the circus element and didn't look at what Phil Donahue was really doing. Yeah. So they took all the worst elements of his legacy, really.
It was all shock all the time with those shows, for sure. And I mean, I couldn't help but notice there with your mentions, it sounds like Chicago was really a hub for daytime TV.
I think it absolutely was. I think part of the reason, too, is, you know, they didn't want New York or L.A. audiences, where there are all kinds of opportunities, even back in the day, for people to go be a studio audience at a sitcom taping or a talk show. Chicago's the third largest city. It's a huge market, but it draws from the Midwest.
Right.
So, you know, what I would walk through the NBC tower, Sasha, and you'd see people lining up to see these shows, or in the case of Donahue, it was CBS and WGN. And they looked like America.
Yeah.
You know, it was people from Wisconsin, from downstate Illinois, from Indiana, from Michigan, from the Chicago suburbs. So you didn't get that jaded, cynical audience. You got an audience that was really excited to be there for the Phil Donahue show.
Right. And you got to see Donahue up close? Sort of, when you were an intern?
Yeah, I did. I was an intern at one of the radio stations that was in the same building as the old WBBM TV studios. Well, you know, for people who know this, CBS2 now is right in the loop, but it used to be in River North, and it was this old barn building where, you know, speaking of politics, John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon had their first televised event there. So it had this long history, and that's where Phil Donahue was taping. I was on an intern at a radio station, but every once in a while when they couldn't fill all the seats for Phil Donahue's show, and that was usually because there was a huge snowstorm, they try to get seat fillers from in the building. Hey, anybody want to go down? So I actually got to go down for a few shows and sit in the audience, including one where he talked to Lana Turner, the iconic movie star. So, you know, he would also do things like that, hour-long interviews with authors and actors and politicians.
That's Chicago Sun-Times Entertainment columnist Richard Roper discussing the career of Phil Donahue, who some call the king of daytime television. For several years, his show originated in Illinois, in Chicago. Well, how did a liquor that by all accounts tastes awful become a symbol of Chicago? From the WBEZ Curious City podcast, reporter Adriana Cardona-McGigad has the story of Malort.
Guess what liquor is being described here?
If I had to kind of boil it down scientifically, I would say it tasted like baby aspirin wrapped in grapefruit peel, tied up with rubber bands, and then soaked in well gin.
If you guess Malort, you're right. The spirit has become a Chicago rite of passage over the past decade. And Curious City listener Kevin McDermott wondered
how it went from a very obscure drink in a handful of dive bars to becoming a symbol of Chicago.
Malort has been around since the 1920s when Swedish immigrant Carl Jepson first produced it in Chicago during the Prohibition era. He marketed this wormwood-infused alcohol as medicine to treat parasites. But how did this Swedish tonic go from collecting dust on bar shelves to becoming a Chicago staple? Well, that has a lot to do with a bartender named Sam Mecklin. Sam didn't quite enjoy his first taste of Malort, but there was an undeniable spark.
I was so just gobsmacked with the novelty of it and the uniqueness of it. And as a person that has a sense of humor that's a little bit biting sometimes, it was like meeting your future wife, you know what I mean? It was just like, it knocked me out.
Sam loved getting people's first reaction to Malort. And what started out as a drinking game among friends became a full-blown DIY marketing campaign. He started hosting Malort theme events at bars where he worked.
Somehow, by miracle, I obtained the handle at Jepson's Malort across all social media platforms. And I'd begun to kind of slowly gather a fan base through a humor-based social media.
He sold Malort t-shirts and started making a little money off a brand that he wasn't officially associated with. This was around the late 2000s. Eventually, that landed him in a little hot water with then Malort owner Patty Gablick and her lawyer.
He asked me, he's like, well, when were you going to pay us for the illegal use of our trademark?
Sam told him he tried to send Patty a check, but it was returned to him. He showed them the heartfelt letter he wrote Patty, and that changed everything. She offered him a job.
It was like going from thinking that I was going to be financially destroyed by this corporation to landing a dream job in the matter of 5 minutes.
Sam saw sales of Malort go from virtually flat to jumping 1,000% by 2014. Patty Gablick retired and sold the brand to Tremaine Atkinson in 2018. He's since expanded sales to 30 states.
It's such a Chicago thing, and I would argue that you're not a bar in Chicago if you don't have a bottle of Malort.
Sam moved to Ohio and is no longer part of the Malort brand. But he says the liquor gave him more than he ever expected. He made tons of friends.
I essentially met my girlfriend, who is going to become my wife pretty soon here. So like everything in my life that I appreciate and that really matters to me came through that process. And yeah, lucky dude.
Sam transformed something old and unwanted into something new and trendy. And seeing its success, he feels he's done his job. Curious City, supported by the Conant Family Foundation, I'm Adriana Cardona Magigat.
We've got more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Illinois Secretary of State Alexei Janulius is trying to increase access to the court system through public libraries. Mawa Iqbal has more details.
18 libraries will have a designated space for people to appear in court remotely, e-file documents, and get legal resources. Most of those libraries are in the Chicagoland area and surrounding collar counties. The libraries were chosen based on factors like broadband internet and transportation constraints, as well as legal need in the area. According to a press release from the Secretary of State's office, the goal is to reach people who don't have legal representation. Janulius, in the release, said libraries have, quote, always served as a hub for learning and finding answers. In addition, some librarians will be trained on how to offer information on specific types of cases like child custody and divorce. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Angela Cummings is the executive director of the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She spoke with reporter Maureen McKinney about trends in suicide rates, the effects of the National 988 Crisis Hotline, and how to help prevent suicide.
I wonder if you can tell me about some of the trends in the fight against suicide.
There had been a decrease in suicide in the years 2019 and 2020. And unfortunately, the pandemic happened, and there were some mental health ramifications to that, of course. And although we had been seeing a decline in the rate, we did see a U-turn. And so the rate has been climbing for the last several years. We only have preliminary data from the CDC right now for 2022, but for 2021, we did see another increase. And so obviously it's a huge concern to us. We like to see this as kind of a temporary blip because we do know that the efforts we were making were making a difference. We were getting a little bit of a reduction in the suicide rate prior to the pandemic. For Illinois, it's the 15th leading cause of death. It's overall, it's the third leading cause of death for people ages 10 to 24, which is definitely something that surprises and shocks a lot of people to hear that. It's also the third leading death for people ages 25 to 34. So it's definitely a leading cause of death for a large demographic in Illinois. Now, those people tend to be healthier and don't die by other causes as much, right? So in terms of real numbers, of course, we still have the largest number of people dying by suicide are men, and particularly middle-age white men. So they make up really the bulk of suicides. That's nationally and in Illinois as well. The overall rate for 2021 was around 48,000 lives lost to suicide nationally. Yeah, it's the 11th leading cause of death. The rates are rising most sharply in our BIPOC communities. So those are, you know, Black, African-American, Hispanic, and Native American communities. So that is a cause of concern, obviously, for AFSP. And we really have doubled our efforts to try to do culturally relevant programming for these communities. And that's not just translating things into Spanish, for example, employing the input of community organizations, experts, people who can work with us to make sure that our programming is not just, again, translated or has like different graphics or different photographs, but is culturally relevant and addresses the, you know, the sort of pervasive cultural impacts that these types of people are facing in their own communities that maybe are unique to those communities. We have A Talk Saves Lives, Latinx, which again has a different look and feel. It's in Spanish or in English, but a real different look and feel to really try to address, you know, the stressors that are happening in those communities. We just launched a Let's Saves Lives, which is kind of a version of Talk Saves Lives, but it is by and for the Black and African American community. And it is a longer program, and it really delves into the impact of systemic racism and overt racism and how that just impacts, you know, mental health in Black and African American communities. We do have an LGBTQ specific program. And we're just doing a lot of work on nationally in other chapters as well, doing a lot of work nationally with you know, on reservations with Native American populations. Those rates are shockingly high. And as you can imagine, you know, it's just a really big problem with a lot of multifactorial reasons.
The 988 system as a suicide hotline recently took effect. Can you explain what that is and how it's working?
So we are still collecting data on that because 988 launched in July of 2022. And as I noted, the CDC lags behind quite a bit in their reporting because they're very thorough. And so the numbers that we have from the CDC currently are only complete for 2021. So there isn't really any way to, you know, match what the data that we've gathered from 988 to any rate data, right? Any direct effect on rates. But what we know is that it is massively successful in Illinois in terms of the number of people who are calling now, right? But I can tell you that Illinois used to be the worst state in terms of calls answered in state and in terms of the wait time. So only 20% of calls before 988 launched were answered in the state of Illinois. The rest of them were farmed out. They were kind of patched out to another nearby state or whoever could take the call. That was just because we didn't have the capacity in Illinois. That's not a great thing. When you don't reach the 988 center in your own state, you're not getting connected to your own local resources. Now, someone can help you in terms of stabilizing you and making sure that you're safe and trying to ascertain if you where you are, if you have a plan, if you have a method, getting emergency services out to you and whatnot. But it's not ideal. Since 988 launched in Illinois, we've completely flipped that. And so now I think it's 82%, maybe even 84% of calls to 988 in Illinois are answered in state. They're answered by a 988 call center here in Illinois. And the wait time is less than 30 seconds, which is amazing. I once had to call 988 on behalf of someone who was confused and had called AFSP. We're not a crisis line. We don't do direct services, but I wasn't going to let them hang up with me. And I called on their behalf and I got a message that said the wait time would be 80 minutes. I couldn't believe it. This was probably 2017, maybe something like that. So we didn't wait. We went to the crisis chat line and online and I started getting them connected that way. And that was a quicker response. But I have heard similar anecdotes from people over the years. So to say that 988 has been a game changer in Illinois is not hyperbole. It is absolutely changed everything. So 988 has three prongs to it. It's definitely the call centers, and those are wildly successful. We're so grateful that those are, you know, well-staffed and being answered and all of that. It's also someone to respond. So those are the mobile crisis units, and those are starting to roll out. And then it's somewhere to go. And that's the third prong of it. It's respite centers, because we know that the emergency room is a very bad place for people to go if they're experiencing a mental health crisis or you know, a suicidal ideation, a suicidal crisis. If it's a suicide attempt in progress, they have to go to the emergency room. But for someone who is just in a very severe crisis moment, they can often recover and faster and have better care if they can just go to a respite center and not have to go to the emergency room. So that's really the dream of 988. Someone to answer, someone to respond, and a place to go. And we're getting there. We're getting there.
What should you do or say if you suspect someone is suicidal?
Most of our education revolves around teaching people the warning signs. These are observable signs that anybody could notice in a friend or family member, a coworker, or themselves. And those warning signs are typically displayed in three main ways, and that's talk, behavior, and mood. People who are suicidal will honestly, quite frankly, talk about it. They may talk about things like feeling like they're a burden, or they're not sure they can go on. They may say that they're overwhelmed, that you would be better off without me, but they can sometimes joke about it too. And that can put people off and think that they're not serious. So we always say, if someone is mentioning suicide in any way, to take it seriously. Behavior, these are behaviors that are atypical for the person. They may be withdrawing from activities that they used to really enjoy. They may be giving away their possessions that we know that they really love dearly. They may be sleeping way too much. They may be not sleeping at all, things like that. And then of course, mood is a little more subtle, but they could be really agitated. They may not always seem depressed. They may be more angry. We typically see this in men a lot, that they express suicidality more in a way that seems angry or aggressive. But any changes in talk, mood, or behavior is kind of a sign that you will want to reach out. So that's the next part of it. If you can recognize these warning signs, what should you do? And that is the basis of our campaign, which is called Talk Away the Dark. And Talk Away the Dark is a site that we developed that people can go to. We might worry that saying the wrong thing will make it worse, so we end up not saying anything, even though just a few kind words can make the difference in connecting someone to help or supporting someone who has experienced a suicide loss. And so it is tips and tools for approaching someone who you may be worried about or concerned about, how you ask directly, and we always want to ask directly. We don't want to beat around the bush. We don't want to say vague things like, is everything okay? Are you thinking of hurting yourself? When a person has reached a suicidal crisis, they kind of think they've found an answer. They think they've made a plan and they've got it figured out. And so these kind of vague questions don't get to the heart of it. They may say, no, I'm fine. I've got it figured out. I feel better now. And they may be feeling better in that moment because they think they've figured it out.
What should you say to someone who you recognize as perhaps being suicidal?
Ask directly. You can say things like, I've noticed changes in you recently. I'm very concerned about you. Are you considering suicide? Have you thought about killing yourself? Now, saying those things out loud seems so awkward for so many people. It even seems awkward for me. And I've probably said this dozens of times, maybe hundreds of times. I've told this advice to people. It does seem awkward, but you really have to just get past that awkward moment and be direct. What data has shown when we've interviewed people who have been in this crisis moment and someone has asked them directly, what has been reported back is that when someone asks directly, it's like a weight lifted off of their shoulders. They don't have to be vague themselves. Someone gets it. They can just say, yes, actually it has become that bad. I have thought of that. It has entered my mind. And it's just like a release to them. That's most people report that when they've been asked directly. Now you will potentially run up against someone who will get angry with you and say, no, I would never think about doing that. I would never consider that. How dare you? We always say, you know, that's a risk that you're going to take as a friend reaching out, and it's a risk worth taking. And when the person's mental health is better and their suicidal ideation kind of subsides and they get to feeling better, they now know that you're a safe person. You've asked that question. And more often than not, they're going to realize that you are acting out of, you know, care, kindness, concern. And they'll know that if they ever do need to reach out for help, that you are a person who understands, is non-judgmental, and it is a safe space.
Angela Cummings is executive director of the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Talk of abortion seemed to be everywhere during the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Illinois was celebrated for welcoming thousands of women needing the procedure, but abortion funds that help women travel here for care are running out of money. Kristen Schorsch has more.
One speaker after another energized the crowd at the United Center to protect abortion.
In Texas, doctors who have feared going to jail have sent patients to wait in hospital parking lots.
I'm here tonight because the fight for reproductive rights isn't just a woman's fight. This is about fighting for our families.
And when Congress passes a bill to restore reproductive freedom, as President of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law.
That's Alexis McGill Johnson of Planned Parenthood, Josh Zarowski from Texas, and Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. But as abortion funds across the country cut back what financial help they can provide, doctors and advocates worry what this means for patients. The stakes are high in Illinois. More people travel here than to any other state to get an abortion. That's according to the Guttmacher Institute, a pro-abortion research group. One of the biggest abortion funds is in Chicago. It's run by Megan Jaifo.
Access has always been an issue in this country, and access is not what's being discussed. And while we're waiting for whoever to be elected and Congress to pass whatever, and I'm going to sign this the minute it's on my desk, that is going to take a long time. What are we doing as a community to address the real needs that people have right now?
As national abortion funds have cut back, patients and doctors are leaning more on the Chicago Abortion Fund to fill in the gap. Jaifo says the fund is set to receive about $5 million from the state, but she still needs to dip into reserves. The fund has started to turn patients away unless they live in or are receiving abortions in Illinois or four other states, including Wisconsin and Iowa.
Our biggest fear is that we cannot create incredible conditions for people to be able to access abortion care in our state and then have them only available to a select few, which is what will happen if abortion funds are not resourced. The protections in Illinois will only be available to people who can afford to get on a plane or fill up their car with gas and pay for a hotel and take off of work, et cetera, et cetera.
Dr. Allison Cowett is the medical director of one of the biggest independent abortion clinics in the U.S. It's in Chicago. She fears what will happen to her patients. About 30% of them come from other states.
Our staff that answers the phone is totally unused to having a conversation with people about bringing large sums of money to the clinic. And it's heartbreaking.
Now staff is being trained how to make the ask. An abortion in the first 3 months of pregnancy typically costs around $500. All of this is raising questions about who could step up to help pay for and even expand access to abortions. Some people point to Cook County's public health system. It's one of the largest of its kind in the country and treats a lot of uninsured patients. County Board President Tony Preckwinkle has been relatively quiet about abortion compared to city and state leaders. She says she supports reproductive rights, but doesn't talk about it much for safety reasons.
Protecting our patients and protecting our healthcare providers has to be our first priority, and that takes precedence over promoting the services that we provide. And I don't want, frankly, to be in a situation where anybody who comes into our hospital has to cross a line of protesters who, knowing that we provide reproductive, full-scale reproductive health care, have decided that they are going to, you know, picket or protest our hospital.
This summer, the county added more days when patients can get abortions. Jaifo wants to see a creative federal fix, like how the government rallied during the COVID-19 pandemic and gave local governments, including Cook County, money to help recover. For her, this is deeply personal. Jaifo thinks back to her own abortion about 25 years ago in Milwaukee. She says it was an awful experience. No financial or emotional support. the kind the Chicago Abortion Fund provides. Kristen Schorsch, WBEZ News.
Coming up, activists protesting outside the Democratic National Convention faced an age-old dilemma. We'll have that story on the way. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Social justice activists have long faced a predicament. If they protest peacefully, the media often ignore them. There can be a lot of news coverage if they're militant or violent, but that attention tends to be negative, and it can spark a public backlash. Chip Mitchell reports how the dynamics played out during the recent Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
On the convention's second night, I covered a candlelit vigil to remember the tens of thousands of people killed by Israel in Gaza since the October 7th Hamas attacks. The vigil drew 120 people and called for an arms embargo against Israel. The speakers included Christians, Jews, and Muslims. But if you look online for traces of news coverage, apart from WBEZ, you won't find much. So where were the reporters that night? Many were outside the Israeli consulate downtown. A group of young protesters there had been promoting their action as an opportunity to get beaten by police. My colleague Michael Puente was on it. He says there were dozens of reporters.
Cameramen, photographers, especially early on, it seemed like there was more media out there than protesters.
Everybody wants to see the carnage.
Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling the next morning mocked those journalists.
Why should we cover the people who are talking about peace? I want to capture the picture of the officer with the billy club smashing into someone's head. And then I want to talk about how terrible the Chicago Police Department is.
Experts say violent protests have become more common in the U.S. since the 2016 election. One peak followed George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police in 2020. Protests in dozens of cities mushroomed into rioting. Omar Wasso is a University of California, Berkeley political scientist. He says the media and the public tend to ignore peaceful protest tactics, while the coverage of militant tactics is generally unfavorable.
And so there's what some scholars have called an activist's dilemma, where you've got two, you know, sort of unsatisfying choices potentially, peaceful but unobserved and militant but unsympathetic.
Still, Wasso says there are ways for activists to get around the dilemma. One is to stage entertaining spectacles like this 1991 protest by the group ACT UP.
They took a giant sort of fake condom and put it over Senator Jesse Helms's home to protest the ways in which he was blocking funding for research on AIDS.
Wasso said another peaceful route to sympathetic news coverage is to hold big protests, really big, like the March on Washington of 1963 or the Women's March of 2017. Protesters can also position themselves as targets of violence by law enforcement, a tactic made famous by Martin Luther King Jr. in places like Birmingham and Selma. David S. Meyer is a University of California, Irvine sociologist.
Harsh conduct from authorities or repression can easily backfire, creating a new cause and creating sympathy for protesters.
Now, peaceful protesters can still get favorable media attention, even if their movement has a militant flank. In the early 60s, Malcolm X was talking about black liberation using any means necessary. In the media, King's nonviolent approach seemed less threatening. Even last week, the protesters outside the Israeli consulate came off as violent and dangerous. Their message mostly got lost. But they may have opened some political space for the so-called uncommitted delegates at the convention over at the United Center.
In our discussions with Vice President Harris's team, we made very clear our ask is for a Palestinian-American speaker to speak from this stage.
They were holding a nonviolent sit-in, demanding a primetime slot on TV. The sit-in got a lot of sympathetic media coverage, but these are the exceptions. Most peaceful protests still go unnoticed. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
Multiple court decisions challenging President Biden's most generous student loan repayment plan have thrown Illinois borrowers into chaos. Lisa Currian Phillip explains.
Chicagoan Jesus Ayala Jr. signed up for the income-based SAVE plan to make his student loan payments affordable. But as the plan faces multiple court challenges, he's been put on administrative forbearance, he thinks.
I actually don't know that for a fact.
He hasn't gotten any communication about it. All he knows is the headway he's made towards loan cancellation under a program for nonprofit workers is halted.
Every time I feel like I'm making progress, there's always something new that makes me feel like this may not be a good outcome.
Ayala Jr. says there's got to be a better system.
Lisa Curry and Phillip with that report. Well, school districts across the country have received millions of dollars of federal COVID relief over the past few years, but that funding is about to expire. Peter Medlin reports.
Brian DiBernardi walks along the outside of Northwest Elementary School in LaSalle. He's the superintendent.
Yeah, so you can see where this kind of juts out. None of this was here.
He points to a 15,000 square foot addition to the school. It's brand new. Kids just stepped in the doors last week. Northwest is a small school where a majority of kids are low income, and DiBernardi says they just didn't have enough space for their students.
We never had an art room. We never had a music room. We were down to using storage closets and mechanical rooms to do a lot of things.
They also renovated another wing of the school, and none of it would be possible without ESSER. That would be Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief. It's pandemic relief money from the federal government, and school districts have had the past several years to spend that money, and it expires in about a month. We're talking about millions of dollars, even in a smaller district like LaSalle. DiBernardi says it made up a healthy portion of their budget. And now that it's gone, are Illinois schools headed towards a financial cliff? Well, Angie Smith says it depends on how schools spent the money. She helps lead school business operations at the Aurora West School District and wrote her dissertation about the impact of ESSER. And her district, like LaSalle, spent a lot of money on capital projects like new roofs and HVAC systems, and they spent less money on things like hiring new teachers. And that is for a simple reason.
This is not permanent money.
So they focused on one-time expenses instead of ongoing costs that'll stick around even when the federal funding ends. But that's not just limited to construction. Many districts like Aurora West upgraded technology, gave teachers bonuses, and started summer school programs to get their students back on track after the initial disruption of the pandemic.
We added restorative practice coaches that, you know, worked with students, things that either weren't going to be long-term or in some cases, we piloted them and liked them, but then had to figure out what comes out of the budget to make room for that.
Ann Williams at the U46 district in Elgin says they also have to consider if these new programs, projects, and positions are helping students. Are they getting a solid return on their investment? And she says that's not always simple. It's easier to think about with tutors. You pay for tutors. Did the tutoring help students improve in that area? Pretty straightforward. But what about construction? Going from learning in a storage closet to a new classroom, how much does that help students improve academically? William says it's a little harder to measure, but they do try.
Looking at the social, emotional learning and development of students, we have surveys for employee engagement that allow us to evaluate.
Marguerite Rosa is the head of the research center Edgenomics, and she's worried that many students are not back on track academically.
Illinois broadly, compared to most other states, we saw pretty strong growth in reading, less so in math.
In her dissertation, a question Angie Smith set out to answer was, are these funds going to lead to systemic change in education, or is it just some extra money? She says because it's a one-time thing, it's just extra money. But some say this has made a lasting change. DiBernardi thinks about their new school addition and classroom renovations. Without ESSER, it may have taken another 20 years to build. Another whole generation of students come and gone without the adequate space they need to learn. In LaSalle, students are performing better on state tests than pre-pandemic in both reading and in math, but other districts are still playing catch-up, and now they're playing catch-up without this extra money, and if they didn't spend it wisely, with fewer resources to help their kids. I'm Peter Medlin.
A months-long investigation into homeschooling in Illinois finds several problems. Jennifer Fuller has more on that story.
The investigation from Capital News Illinois and ProPublica details cases of educational neglect where kids are kept from going to school, putting vulnerable children at risk of not getting an education or of abuse and neglect. Illinois, reporters found, has few rules when it comes to homeschooling. Parents can keep their children home for any reason, and the state doesn't require standardized testing or checkups to make sure kids stay on track with their studies. While many homeschool families follow online or other curricula, some vulnerable children receive no education. In extreme cases, abuse and neglect are found.
It's sad. They're heartbreaking stories that, you know, where kids are being denied schooling because their parents are irresponsible and they don't want the accountability of getting them up, getting them dressed, getting them to school.
Kyle Thompson is the regional superintendent of schools for an area covering parts of East Central Illinois. Regional school superintendents are tasked with tracking truancy and working with families to get children back into the classroom. But once a family says the student is homeschooled, the superintendents have no more jurisdiction. Sometimes, Thompson says, families will ask for help with homeschooling, but options from the Regional Office of Education are limited.
You wouldn't believe how many people say, hey, I'm homeschooled, what can you give me? And, like, I have that conversation a few times a year. I'm like, nothing. Like, this is on you. We're giving you the public schools. Like, you know, if you don't want to do that, then it's on you.
Child welfare advocates say some cases they see are troubling. Children who are abused or neglected but rarely see anyone outside their home are falling through the safety nets created to protect them. The regional offices of education typically have staff who do home visits, mainly to investigate reports of truancy. But John Cox and Jeff Bink, truancy interventionists with the ROE based in downstate Marion, say that's not always the answer to the problem.
We will go out and do a home visit on them and see why they're not registered at school, try to figure out, break down the barriers of, are they going to enroll or are they doing homeschool? And most of them that we get when we go there, they say we are homeschooling our kids. And that's a lot of the reports that you get. It's concerned citizens that see kids running around outside the house and they're like, how come this kid's not in school? So we go out there and then they tell us that they're homeschooling. Of course, in the state of Illinois, they don't have to register for homeschooling. So once they give that verbal, it's pretty much out of our hands.
Reporters in this investigation highlighted one case where a child in Rock Island died after accidentally shooting himself in December of 2022. His mother then hid the body, telling a friend she didn't want her other children to be taken away. And since he was homeschooled, quote, nobody knows, he's not in school. 7 months passed before police found his body in a trash can in the garage. His mom, Sushi Staples, originally faced charges of concealing a death, failure to report the death of a child within 24 hours, and obstructing justice. Staples pleaded guilty to felony endangering the health of a child, and in April, she was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Illinois' Department of Children and Family Services is the agency obligated to investigate reports of abuse and neglect, but it does not investigate schooling matters. The General Assembly removed that authority from them in 1990 and gave it to the regional offices of education. But many, like Superintendent Matthew Hickam in far southwestern Illinois, say they don't know what to do either.
Homeschooling can certainly work well. Some people do it extremely well, but yeah, there needs to be some kind of layer of accountability that's possible so that it isn't so easy for kids to slip through the cracks. I don't know what the legislative answer is. It seems like, just in my brief amount of time, that there just seems to be a lot of powerful interest groups that are preventing or put up the roadblocks to keep anything from going through at the state level.
Efforts to pass legislation updating regulations on homeschooling face stiff opposition. Homeschool groups organize large lobbying efforts to defeat the bills they oppose. They believe it's the parents' right to decide how to educate their children without state interference. Kirk Smith is with Illinois Christian Home Educators.
All we want is to be left alone, and Illinois has been so good. We have probably the best state in the nation to homeschool. They recognize our numbers are very successful.
Smith goes on to say students affiliated with his organization do well academically, too.
The government here has been so good to recognize that and to say, let's leave these folks alone and do what they do because they're being successful for it.
Statistics show in 2022, the number of children withdrawn from traditional schools in favor of homeschooling in Illinois was double what it was 10 years before. And experts say that's likely an undercount. Parents are not required to tell their local school district that they're keeping their children home. Education leaders, along with child welfare advocates, say they're continuing to work on ways to protect children while maintaining parents' rights in Illinois. I'm Jennifer Fuller, Capital News, Illinois.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being along with us, and don't forget to join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.